Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Liberty on the Air. I'm your host, Dan Fishman. I'm in studio with Jeff Lyons, Ken Van Tassel. If you want to join the conversation with us, the number is 617-266-6868. You can send us a text at 680-680. You can tweet us at Liberty on the Air. We're not really good about responding to tweets, but definitely you can give it a try. Better off trying to call in. Our big show today, you know, we're talking about Thanksgiving, because Thanksgiving's coming up, and Thanksgiving's the only real American holiday. I mean, you can argue that Mother's Day is an American holiday because it's like super capitalist, invented by Hallmark to sell greeting cards. But Thanksgiving's the original American holiday. And it's a lot about, welcoming people to your table. When I was growing up,
Saying the Native Americans didn't have holidays?
Well, it's an interesting question.
I got you there, Dan.
All right. Already.
Name one.
I'm not a Native American scholar. I mean, come on.
Right.
If you are, call in and let us know what an original American holiday might be.
Would be interesting to know.
I'm sure that they have harvest-based holidays. We just don't know the name of them because we're culturally sensitive.
That's a little bit condescending.
However, all right. So the only
just to derail your entire
yeah, that's
opening,
all right.
No problem.
The only American, well, but I wouldn't call them American, right? I mean, they had their own country. They're native to America. But are Canadians Americans? Are Mexicans Americans?
Yes,
I mean, they're North Americans.
Yes,
but okay. Well, the only United Statesian holiday.
Exactly.
The only United Statesian holiday is Thanksgiving, and it's about acceptance. It's about accepting the fact that the pilgrims were starving, right? They had nothing going on for them. The Wampanoag tribe helped them out, tolerated these people, welcomed them in. And we've talked before about how liberty and tolerance are two sides of the same coin. And I don't have my liberty if the two other guys in the studio don't tolerate it, or if Will doesn't tolerate it, right? Will could silence my mic right now, and I would stop going out over the airway. So I don't really have freedom of speech. Ken and Jeff could probably overpower me. I mean, I have the strength of 10 men, but maybe not. But liberty and tolerance in general, people have to tolerate you exercising your liberty. So our society has felt like it's becoming more intolerant. And I think you'd have to be living under a stone to not see that happening. And here in Massachusetts and around the country, there are a lot of signs popping up. And they say, hate has no home here. And if you do a Google search right now for hate has no home here, you'll see these yard signs all over the place. Say, hate has no home here. There's a heart with an American flag in it. And then they have, I assume, says hate has no home here in Arabic and Sanskrit and Hebrew and French and Korean and a few other languages. So the interesting thing about that, though, is that in Massachusetts, I often feel like that is a strained idea, the idea that hate really has no home here, because tolerance in Massachusetts, we've talked about this before, is usually not tolerance. Usually what tolerance is in Massachusetts is that a lot of people have a consensus of ideas. We are fundamentally a one-party state. And whenever somebody is outside of that realm, you don't see the other party practicing tolerance. Richard Tesei, who was my opponent in the 2012 congressional race, who was an out gay man, wasn't married at the time, but a longtime partner. Richard used to say that he experienced more hate speech directed against him in Massachusetts because he was a Republican than instead of was directed toward him as being a gay man. And, that's not shocking to anybody who lives in Massachusetts. Massachusetts has always been very tolerant of marriage equality. As far back as 1994, Bill Weld appointed a judge to the Supreme Court who ended up writing the ruling that said that marriage is not a providence of the state. It is actually a right that people are entitled to. When we talk about that now, there was just another free speech rally out on the common. This one was under the guise of resist Marxism. And it was more peaceful than the last rally. In general, I don't think that people were as angry about it. There weren't the same number of crowds. But friend of the show and congressional candidate in New Hampshire, Justin O'Donnell, was assaulted while he was on the common because he was walking around with a Gadsden flag in a rainbow, colored Gadsden flag. And we have Justin on the line right now. So, Justin, what can you tell me about what happened down at the rally? How did you get assaulted?
It was basically just walking around. Same deal as the August rally. Boston police only let certain people into the bandstand area. They were a little bit more lenient, at least letting the media in this time. But I did have a very dangerous water bottle in my backpack, so I wasn't allowed in.
Was it metal or was it plastic?
It was a Gatorade bottle that I bought at the 7-Eleven across the street.
Gotcha.
You couldn't throw it away?
Well, at that point, I figured they'd caught everyone off. They turned me away, and they wouldn't let me go back in. So I figured I'd hang out and go back and find Vermin Supreme back in the crowd, because it's always at least a good time around Vermin.
Absolutely. Love hanging out with Vermin.
Characters. But on the way back there, I was carrying my rainbow Gadsden flag, and the symbolism of the rainbow flag is completely lost when all they can see is the evil no-step-on-sneck Gadsden Jack.
Interesting. And the interesting thing about it is that, you know, that's become a meme for people who don't know. No-step-on-sneck, S-N-E-K, which is meant to mock the Gadsden flag, the famous don't-tread-on-me flag, that, at least for people in the Liberty Movement, symbolizes what we think is a shared universal idea that everybody has a right to not be stepped on.
Don't tread on anyone.
Yeah. So you're walking across the common with this flag that has that is obviously a pro-LGBT flag in addition to being a Gadsden flag. Yes?
Yes. It was a group of self-identified communists. I won't even use the term communist as a descriptor to insult them.
Right.
They were carrying Soviet Union flags themselves, wearing anti-fascista black bloc clothing, wearing masks. And it was a group that I had debated and argued with earlier, actually very loudly, and some news cameras and a bunch of reporters gathered to document that argument I'd had with them before the rally even started.
Yep.
And they identified themselves as Bolshevik communists.
Interesting.
Are the ones who decided to, as I was walking by, grab my flag and try and tear it from my arms. Fortunately, for those of you who know me, I am a rather large gentleman.
Well, what's really interesting about that, though, is that if they identified themselves as Bolshevik communists, they were actually being true to their cause because they do believe in violently suppressing people who disagree with them, right? I mean, that's the essence of Bolshevikism is to, remove your enemies at all cost.
Absolutely, and that was the big premise of our earlier argument, our debate.
I think Dan's giving them too much credit for thinking they actually know what Bolshevik
communists are. There's no question they don't.
I mean, if they're communists, they obviously don't know much about history.
Right.
But they had kept accusing me of being a Nazi sympathizer and a Nazi supporter because I was there to support free speech and the second iteration of the free speech rally. And this particular group are regulars. I've seen them at every rally I've attended in Boston, including Hempfest. I'm not unknown to them, and they're not unknown to me.
When they showed up at Hempfest, were they also masked?
No, they don't wear masks at Hempfest.
Interesting.
They came
to fight, right? I mean, that's all you can say about somebody who shows up in a mask at a place like this, right? They were there for trouble.
Funnily enough, I was standing with a crowd of people at one point in time, a gentleman who identified himself as a libertarian communist to me, but was actually able to have a friendly conversation. And I sat and
can you say those two words in the same sentence? Is that a thing?
Well, by the time we finished our conversation, he wasn't.
Right.
He those are the best conversations to have.
Engage in debate.
Well, it is an interesting, there's always these terms, but there's also sort of fighting terms. So let me ask you this. Why didn't it escalate? How were you able to show restraint?
Because there weren't 4,000 people incensed marching down Commonwealth Ave, maybe?
Yeah, well, in my particular case, I try my best to never escalate.
Okay. Well, it's good. I'm glad that you didn't.
Self-defense. If they're trying to take my flag, I'm going to hold on. I'm going to rip it back.
Right.
If it rips the flag, it rips the flag. If they take the flag, they take the flag.
Well, and
when it comes down to it, the initiation of physical violence is not something I'm willing to initiate.
Well, and so, you know, that's one of the real differences between, I think, the liberty movement and the communist movement. I mean, the communist movement is predicated on the idea that it's absolutely worth it to eliminate the people who won't sign up. And that's really one of the interesting things about it, is that the stated purpose of this rally was resist Marxism. I don't know how true they state to that. I'm not I know a lot of the speakers.
Well, Resist Marxism, from what I gathered, was actually the name of the organization that organized the rally, but they just called it the Rally for the Republic. In fact, one of the first speakers was a lawyer from Boston who was also a professed Democratic Socialist who worked on the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Interesting.
I don't think those words belong in the same sentence either. But
free speech.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You could theoretically have democratic socialism,
yeah,
right? Where, I mean, essentially that's what the unions, that's the ultimate goal of a union, is the idea that the government controls all the means of production and the people would vote on how the government distributes it, but there wouldn't be any private ownership. But, all right, so did you see any other acts of violence? Anybody else get hurt? Are you okay, Justin? I should have asked that out at the beginning. I'm sorry. Oh, I didn't.
I am perfectly fine. In fact, most of the violence, though, it was much, much better contained by the Boston police than the previous rally, much less.
And the crowds were obviously a lot smaller, right?
Well, it was a lot smaller, but there was a lot of recurring.
Yeah.
The people who were aggravating each other, who were attempting to start arguments and physical altercations, were the same people that did it in the August rally.
Interesting.
On both sides. Kyle Chapman, right, or Based Stickman from the free speech rally side, and the same small group of Black Bloc anarchists.
Did Kyle get into it? Did you hear his speech at all?
I did not hear a word of Kyle's speech because at the same time, the Antifa protesters had their own PA system set up and nobody outside of the rotunda could actually hear what was being said inside.
Interesting. So a couple closing thoughts about it. Do you know, is there going to be a third version of this? Or a fourth, I guess?
I joked on Facebook earlier today when I was posting pictures and updates throughout the day as things were going on that I would not be surprised if this just becomes a quarterly event the way they're doing it, staging it every few months.
Do you think that anything was accomplished by this?
Did anything good come out of this at all, or people just hitting each other with pipes?
It would depend on how the media does truly report on it. I know from my own perspective,
you can't depend on
down and representing myself, mingling with not the free speech crowd, but actually mingling.
You look at how the media is
counter-protest.
The media has treated these free speech rallies. They always call it the, quote, free speech rally. They always speak about it as if it's a guise for something else. They never give anything a fair shake anyway. So.
Right. But the interesting thing about it, too, is that, you know, sometimes it feels like it's like if you've ever seen the movie The Warriors, it's like this how do we assemble all our gangs together so that we can fight and, you know, have some sort of confrontation? Because confrontation is what drives the media market. If we're in this, 30-minute news cycle where there has to be a news story all the time, I actually saw that Boston media covered this at, right when it happened. And then they kind of lost the thread and nothing interesting happened. And it never surfaced up in the news again. And maybe the biggest issue that we're looking at right now is having a way to have our news cycle last longer than 30 minutes and have a way for you, the listener, to have an attention span that will get you through a commercial break. Come back with a little Rolling Stone action. We're talking about tolerance. We're talking about hate has no home here. We're talking about crazy acts of intolerance that we see in our everyday lives. We're at this revolutionary moment right now, thanks to the Stones singing about fighting in the streets revolution, where women right now have sort of reached this spot where they, I hope we're as a society, we've reached a spot where they're not going to take it anymore. They're not going to put up with this, aggressive sexual treatment. They're not going to put up with, men slapping them on the ass. We're not going to put up with men saying, if you're willing to do this, you can get a promotion. I have a friend who's running a major campaign in New York State, and she talked about the fact that she actually showed an excerpt where somebody had said to her, I'm happy to make a donation to the campaign. maybe we can talk about it on Pillows later on, which is, you know, it's just ridiculous and completely offensive.
Totally inappropriate.
Yeah. And we have that sort of thing happening all the time, too, where we make sort of jokes about sort of our levels of intolerance in terms of, you know, what we think it's okay to say. And in reality, you know, a lot of times, a lot of that intolerance, especially in terms of political conversations, is hurting our political dialogue here. So a lot of times, like, you know, we were just talking about the fact, you know, we sort of make jokes about communists being stupid because they don't understand history. I mean, that's a fact. That's not a joke. But no. But honestly, if you want to have a political conversation, and Justin talked about this, he talked with somebody who said they were a libertarian communist. He engaged them in a conversation. How often do you find people on the other side who are willing to engage? I'll throw it out to you, Jeff. You spend a lot of time talking about politics. Do you find that people are generally willing to listen to what you have to say, or do you have to find that angle in order to get them to listen to what you have to say?
You know, I find that when you're talking to people, and I've been through these stages, you know, I've been through these phases where like everybody thinks it's kind of fun to like win Facebook arguments and to like troll people and make jokes and stuff. I've been through those phases, and I think that really when it comes down to it, you know, it's fun and games for you, but you're not really accomplishing anything unless you're reaching out to that person and kind of finding something that you have in common and building a rapport and then like using like logic and reason, but like trying to reach out to them.
So when you have a conversation like that, and I think you're right, I try to do the same thing in my engagements, then there's no room for hate for me, because if I have hatred towards somebody else, I'm never going to be able to engage them. I'm never going to be able to convert
them. Yeah, exactly. What Justin said about like de-escalating and be like, let's take it down a notch and like talk to each other as human beings,
right,
and not as two people from two different groups, which like right, realistically, tribal. Exactly. These groups don't exist except in people's imaginations. Like
right.
These labels that we give ourselves, they're not really things. They're just things that people like, I'm joining a team and our teams are against each other and we're going to argue now. It doesn't make sense.
You know, there's an old musical called South Pacific, which you as a Navy man might be familiar with. The Seabees figure heavily, probably the only time they've had a really major motion picture starring role. But in there, there's a song called Carefully Taught. And these children talk about the fact that they have to be carefully taught to be afraid of the Japanese children on the island, because otherwise they would just hang out and play with them as kids. And there's sort of this idea that we keep reinforcing our tribalism, that we inadvertently are teaching our children and future generations to hate the other side. And you see that more clearly now in the way that people are working. You know, when people talk about Donald Trump, there's the, you know, the Catholic Church used to have this idea where they would say, hate the sin, but love the sinner. And that was their approach to homosexuality, gambling, other sins. And I always thought it was a very interesting point, because as an organization that at least in theory is supposed to be dedicated to the idea of, you know, love, right? I mean, the commandment, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If that's your sole purpose, then you should always love the sinner no matter what. And we seem to have completely moved away from that in our politics now, that there is no idea that we say that we are united. You know, I don't quote Barack Obama that much, but his speech at Grant Park, where he said, we are not red states, we are not blue states, we are the United States. That as recently as 8 years ago, I would say, you know what, that meant something. But I don't know if that's true anymore. I mean, if we were going to say there's a unifying American idea, an American ideal, what is it now?
I mean,
yeah.
There isn't one.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't one. It ought to be liberty. It ought to be the Constitution. It ought to be the things that this country was founded upon. But yeah. Right now, I mean, people have like these sort of I don't know. I think when you look at it, it really is like American History X right now.
Yeah.
Like there are – and that analogy goes to both sides of this equation, where like people are feeding on fear of the other.
Right.
Left and right, doesn't matter. But people are – there are heinous – and extreme groups of people out there that are preying on normal, everyday, centrist, moderate people and saying, if you don't come to one side, if you don't come to this side, the other side is going to do this to you, and so on and so forth.
Right. And I mean, that's really sort of the purpose. I mean, now that we're finding out what the Russians actually did, that was the purpose. That's what they wanted to do, is they wanted to polarize us and convince us there couldn't be a moderate ground, and convince us that the two poles always had to stand against each other. And maybe, you know, just maybe, in my most optimistic moments, I think maybe the Russians did us a favor. Maybe they woke us up to the fact that we are getting so far removed from this idea of unity. And maybe
they did Zuckerberg a favor.
Yeah.
And maybe we're going to find our way back. Stevie Ray Vaughan brings us back. I want to talk a little bit more about this issue, and then we're going to move on to talk about the tax plan. You know, as I guess I sounded a little despondent there at the end, and as despondent as I might have sounded,
the rest of America.
Yeah, well, and I think rightfully so, we're a little jaded, but it's not like this moment hasn't happened before in history. You know, in the 50s, there's sort of this illusion that everything was awesome. We just won Second World War. We were the best nation in the world. Our production was awesome. Everybody's home life was awesome. And yeah, then the 60s.
Dan, why don't you go ask some black Americans from the 1950s and ask them how great it was.
Well, but that's exactly my point, is that that's what I wanted to sort of talk about, is that we had this wake-up call that made us realize that, in fact, actually, there were two polar opposites. And at first, there were a lot of people who wanted to maintain the status quo and keep the group separate and maintain this wonderful lifestyle for a select group of people. And then on top of that, you can throw, you know, Vietnam cranks up. We start sending troops into Southeast Asia. The 60s end up being this incredibly violent decade, right? Martin Luther King is assassinated. JFK is assassinated. RFK is assassinated. Malcolm X is assassinated. And it seems like everything's going to heck, and we found our way out. And so, as despondent as I am, I have a great deal of faith in the American people and in the American system. And although I don't often say that I'm a believer in American exceptionalism, I believe that America itself is exceptional, and that our ability to resolve problems together. And so I think that we're going to do that again.
Sounds like you want to make America great again, Dan.
I do want to make America great again. I just might be doing it differently than the guy in the White House. And speaking of which, let's talk about this tax bill, because it's pretty crazy. So first of all, you know, it's a tax cut, but it's a tax cut that blatantly increases the deficit, right? There's no illusion about it. The deficit is going to rise year after year after year.
In keeping with tradition.
Yeah, yep. Well, I mean, that's the rub, is like, you know, we want tax cuts for us. But while we're in debt and while we're in a budget deficit, we're going to continue to add to the debt if we cut taxes before we cut spending.
Right. So, you know, there have been plans in the past.
Let's do both. Let's cut taxes.
Let's cut all of the
spending.
Cut spending
twice as much.
Down to zero.
Right. Well, you know, it's a really good idea.
Keep taxes where they are until we pay off the debt, and then cut that to zero, and then we're good.
Well, there was this great plan by George Bush Sr. called PAYGO that he passed in 1990. And you may remember, nobody else in this room.
That's why he lost re-election, right?
It is why he lost re-election, because
he promised, no, read my lips, no new
taxes.
That's what
I was going to say. I can't believe you don't actually remember that.
Except
you've seen
that
videotapes.
I was like two.
Yeah, exactly.
We saw SNL skits about it.
Exactly. You saw the Dana Carvey sketches about it. So I remember that very clearly. But so he cut a deal with Congress where he said, okay.
Please don't make me a one-termer.
Yeah. I will find a way to not balance the budget, but I will raise taxes for you, Congress, if in return for which you agree that all new spending items have to be actually paid for, which means that you can't just borrow money. You're going to have to raise taxes to pay for it. Congress said, okay. And so they did it. So they passed this thing called PAYGO. It was a 10-year plan. And sure enough, at the end of that 10 years, because every time Congress wanted something new, they had to either tax or take the money off of another program, the U.S. government had a surplus. We didn't have a deficit at the end of the year. So people credited Bill Clinton for it. But in reality, Clinton had nothing to do with it. It was an unavoidable conclusion that the government was going to get a surplus because they couldn't spend more money than they have. And then in 2000, George Bush Jr., considered extending his father's plan, but then 9/11 happened and they threw the whole thing out. They said, oh, we need all the money we have, so that we can go invade Iraq and Afghanistan.
And even the money we don't have.
Exactly. And the money we don't have. And that's what happened. So since then, since 2001, we've been on a 16-year continually increasing deficit. The deficit has been raised, I don't know, five times, six times. The ceiling, the debt ceiling has been raised six times. And the debt ceiling is – go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say maybe if we go so far into debt, we'll get all the way down to China. And then they can just take their money back.
Well, so there is – there is a theory. If you believe in the Dick Cheney as evil mastermind theory, which many people do, there's a theory that they deliberately crashed the economy. The first thing they did was they borrowed a tremendous amount of money from China. Then they crashed the economy. And then they paid the Chinese back with fractional worth of what they borrowed in the first place. Is it true? Is it rumor? I don't know. It is what actually happened. The United States definitely benefited from it at the cost of, some Chinese wealth, some Chinese expansion. But
they play some funny games too.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. They devalued their currency to get back at us for that. I mean, deliberately.
They're learning slowly but surely.
Yeah. If you invest in the Chinese stock market, you are the biggest rube there ever was, because at any point in time, the Chinese government can say, okay, stock market closed. Everything's now worth 20% less than what it was beforehand.
I was really nervous you were about to do an accent there.
No. Sorry. If I was going to do an accent, I don't think I would have done one at that point of time. But no, there's that.
But at the same time, there's problems with the economies, between the United States and China. But at the same time, we have a lot of tech companies that are actually benefiting both countries.
Because people can escape.
That Apple, who are making their expensive electronics, that's what allows iPhones to be as cheap as $1,000 in the United States because of the low labor costs in China.
Yeah, but do you ever take a step back and realize that like a lot of these products being made in China are actually being made with like pennies a day slave labor, like the sneakers, everything, all these products.
Yeah, what's the alternative for those employees? It might be starvation. It might be
arguably
no job at all.
They live in terrible, terrible conditions as their country. That's their country.
It is an interesting point in that because
we're benefiting from it,
right? It's not.
Well, it's a mutual benefit. That's the beauty of capitalistic exchange, is mutual benefit.
Except that, I mean, for example, North Korea sends laborers into China and to Russia, and when they go to China and Russia, they are treated like slaves. They work, incredibly long hours. They're given terrible living conditions, terrible food, and the North Koreans love it. They love it because it's so much better than what they have at home.
Yeah.
And so they are literally captive labor. And so there's an interesting argument
there's
a
difference between being able to voluntarily come and go as you please or take a job as you please versus being a slave sold out of your own country.
And it's a little different. It's an interesting point that these giant Chinese factories, there was a big scandal about it with Apple and the iPhone where the suicide rate.
Yeah, Foxconn factory.
Yeah, Foxconn, sure. Exactly right. Yeah. Suicide rate was enormous. And Apple.
But this is a point that even the far left economist Paul Krugman has written papers about, agreeing that we see the side of it from the United States saying, look how poor off these people are for working in these kind of factories.
Right.
But he has done the analysis and looked at what is the alternative for a lot of these people. And a lot of times it's working in electronic waste distilleries,
melting down
plastics and ingesting horrible chemicals.
Yep.
And that the fact that that companies bring their development there to build these products actually moves along their economic development as a country.
It does, because, as the individual citizens become wealthier, and really, it is sort of a wealth transfer in that we are giving some of our wealth to them and paying them for their services. We are a rising tide lifts all boats, right? As the United States becomes wealthier.
But does that really work in China? It's a communist country, and all the wealth that China is making off of this is really going to the government class of people. It's not going to the sweatshop workers.
It's not going to the sweatshop workers, but
they China might get a nickel raise at Christmas.
Yeah. It's a legitimate point. I think if we had another place to go with labor, we would go there to go with
Now a lot of stuff's made in Malaysia or Indonesia.
It is. The giant Chinese electronic factories are
– there's a lot of manufacturing in Mexico still.
Unique unto themselves. Well, and people saying that the next big thing is Africa, that they're going to start moving these
electronic factories. And it's interesting also that China is the biggest real estate developer on the African continent in many countries in Africa.
Yeah, that's why we have troops out there that nobody knew about.
Well, and what's really interesting too is that, you know, the Chinese wealth actually is enormous. They have very wealthy citizens right now. They have sort of an oligarchy. And is that the correct step to undermining communism? Is that what happened in Russia, right? Did the oligarchs, we made them wealthy enough that they were able to eventually push the system out? I don't know.
I think Hong Kong is the way you fight communism in the region there.
I mean, there was an interesting question. Is Hong Kong going to swallow China at one point in time?
But you know, this last election cycle, it's an interesting place.
Yeah, it's very different. Certainly very different from regular China. But they've been clamping down. I don't know exactly what the end result is going to be. But I do know that this new tax plan, part of the reasons that they're –
is that what we're talking about?
That's what we're talking about. Part of the reason that they're presenting it this way is one of the biggest things about it is that they want to crank down the corporate tax rate so that American companies don't do as much business overseas so that they keep money here at home.
For sure.
And that's something I think most economists do agree upon, that if corporate tax rate were cut – how is that ever bad for the American economy?
Not only does it need to be cut, though, it's also because the United States has one of the largest corporate tax rates of all developed nations in the world.
We're chasing them all out of the country.
Right.
And people get upset about it, but it's like, well, if it was your money, what would you do?
And people – I think people struggle to understand the idea of a corporate tax because, you know, the company pays payroll taxes on everything they pay out to people.
Yeah.
They pay sales tax in the states that they buy supplies that they use to – you know, the executives pay their own income tax.
And
so why should it be taxed three or four times?
But you know what? The companies don't also just pay payroll tax. They pay payroll, right? How much more do we want them to do for the United States? How much more do we want Walmart to do for the United States other than employing a million people a day?
You know, I think it's interesting when people like – when people do their taxes, like you probably scratch your chin and try to think of every, you know, tax deduction that you could possibly make. Like, oh, did I donate enough money to get a couple bucks back on my taxes? And then at the end of the year, then they'd be like, oh, we can't give these guys tax breaks.
Yeah. No, exactly. And the other thing about it is that let's say that all of a sudden Walmart, right, they get a 10% tax break and they get they have, let's say, another $1 billion to spend. We know what Walmart's going to spend that money on. They're going to open up another store. Why is that bad for the American economy? If a company has more money –
I thought they put it under the Walmart mattresses and thumb through it going –
Yeah, Sam Walton in his grave will get an extra.
Everyone knows that's what they do.
Yeah, right. But you know,
no, I'm just kidding. That's what a lot of people would like to think the
but
Walmart
even,
family
even
does.
If they did that, let's just say the worst case scenario, right? They pay all their top executives that extra $1 billion. What rate is that taxed at?
Sure.
39%. So that at least is a flat neutral move. So if they're going to keep all the money for the executives, it's coming as income. The incomes they're going to get taxed at 39%, which happens to be the highest corporate rate right now. So that's neutral. Any money that they put into R&D, that they put into an expansion, they put into hiring more employees, that benefits the company. Corporate income tax is the stupidest idea of all. Pay your employees more, have more employees, that benefits the economy. The idea that we are – the problem is, though, corporations can't vote.
People vote. And people part of a corporation might all vote to do the same
– Exactly. But if I tell you that Walmart's taxes are going up
– Right.
Most people don't care. They say, oh, good. I don't care. Right. Unless you could say, well, you shop at Walmart? Oh, I do shop at Walmart. That $5 t-shirt
to go up?
Exactly. It's going to cost $5.50.
I wanted to pivot, though. We've talked on the show before about student debt issues. And I've actually been getting a lot of emails from so I went to graduate school at the University of Massachusetts. And I'm getting a lot of emails about this tax plan saying you must immediately call your rep and tell them you oppose this tax plan because the graduate student – the money graduate students get to go to school is now going to be considered taxable income under this plan.
Right.
And I'm standing back saying, why should necessarily the federal government be subsidizing? Maybe this will actually force schools to lower their prices instead, but they would love to keep the government on the dole for this money.
Right.
Absolutely not. That's why they're emailing us, telling us to oppose this bill.
I'll give you a couple interesting points. So, we talked with a young lady who was in here earlier, who's, employer is paying for her to go to school.
Yeah.
Let's hypothetically say that's $50,000 a year. Under the new tax plan, she has to declare that as income. So let's say that, you know, she's making $50,000 a year. That's going to push her to $100,000 a year. And so she's going to owe 28% on that extra $50,000, which comes out to $14,000 in taxes she's going to owe. You know, that's a big chunk of change,
yeah,
which you're not expecting to have to pay to the government. Now, the argument is that the government is saying, well, we need that money. I don't want the government to have that money.
Yeah, but the reality is that if fewer people now go to school because of it, what are the schools going to do? They're not going to enroll anybody? No, right. They're going to lower their prices to get people back into the school.
Right. And I think, too, that there's a – so here's the problem with it. I fundamentally, the problem is that whenever you tax income, you're doing it wrong. Okay? Taxing income is always a mistake.
Yeah, that's
and
the root.
Because taxing income is always picking winners and losers no matter what you do. And you're favoring one group over another. And the thing about this is that the exact – according to not the Office of Management and Budget, but one of the other Senate groups that said – the amount of money that they are bringing back in from this tax on graduate students is exactly the same amount of money that they're losing by rolling back the estate tax. So currently right now, there's 2,200 families in the United States that have a large enough estate that they would have to pay the estate tax. And in particular, a lot of these families, you're talking about the difference in billions of dollars of inheritance. So, you know, an $8 billion inheritance is no longer going to be taxed anymore. So we are preserving the money for those billionaires.
Well, should it be taxed when you die or taxed when you work? You know, I think we'd say probably neither.
Right, right. My druthers would be neither. However, the Republican plan is going to say we should not tax billionaires specifically, right? This tax only affects 2,200 families in the United States. And instead, we should tax people who are going to college. I don't want to tax anybody's income, but it's particularly stupid and particularly bad optics to say the money is going to be better left in the hands of the billionaires. If we're just shuffling around paper chips so that we can decide who's going to be the ethical winner and the ethical loser, I would rather see the winners be the people who are actually trying to improve themselves and hopefully through improving themselves, improve the country, than the billionaires who are getting an $8 billion paycheck from daddy.
Let me tell you. So you've seen that when Dan gets worked up, his inner democratic socialist comes out to play. You know, those evil, rich, greedy people.
He's a closet communist. He really is.
Here's the thing.
Me and Jeff are here to keep
wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah. Let me explain this part about it. I don't want there to be an income tax. I think that's the best thing. And then my point
– everyone should pay the same
taxation
income tax.
Is theft.
Zero.
Right. Exactly. Taxation
flat
is theft. Everybody should play
as flat as possible.
As flat as possible.
I completely agree with that. Until that utopia is achieved, and I think that is – I mean, it would be nice if it happened in my lifetime, but right. I'm 50.
No, and you were – and to be fair, you were right when you said the optics of it look bad. Like this is not something that's going to win with a majority of people that don't study tax policy
right.
or anything like that. It's not going to be
exactly
popular.
It. As soon as – and when we talk about, you know, this tolerance, hatred has no home here, you have to be blind to the fact that – I mean, this tax bill pays into every stereotype the Democrats ever preach about the Republicans, that it super benefits the wealthy. It shifts a large portion of the tax burden onto the middle class.
But let's get real. Like that's why Donald Trump is here. He's here to play into every stereotype about Republicans.
But he didn't really run on every stereotype about Republicans, right? I mean, ran on universal health care.
That's just sort of what's happening.
He's going to implement universal
health care. Sort of
what's
happening right now is that like the Republican side of the House is just being as awful as the Democrats say they are.
Right. And so if anything, we're getting more polarized. And so I would ask anybody who is a clear thinking person, look, there are some nice things in this tax plan.
If there's any of you out there.
Yeah. If there's anybody out there at 11:55.
Anybody who's read this.
But this tax plan, right, corporate tax needs to go. It needs to go right away. But it's not worth it when they – it's not worth the political price to make it seem like the poor have to pay the cost for this. Because in reality, they don't have to. We can cut spending. Nobody's talking about cutting spending. All they're talking about is shuffling around taxes. If you're talking about cutting some people's taxes and not other people's taxes, but you're talking about cutting spending, I'll say, okay, it's worth it. As long as we're cutting spending, let's do it. But a bill that increases the deficit, I don't care what the mechanics are behind the scene, that's a bad idea.
Yeah, the problem is when you talk about cutting spending, then it becomes every vein's an artery. And if you take a penny away from me, then all of a sudden the entire program is undermined and like we can't function. Yeah. You know, if you take an ounce, if you take a penny out of education, like the kids aren't going to get
you hate the children
anymore. You right. hate the children.
You know, I've had this idea for a long time that the way we should actually do the budget is, okay, whatever our budget is right now, military gets 40%, entitlement gets 40%, right? NASA gets 1%, health and human services gets 1.7%, whatever the number is.
Where'd you come up with those numbers?
I kind of made them up. it's relatively close.
The Congressional 1.7. Budget Office of Dan.
Yes. But whatever it is, let's take that number and say, okay, that's the number from now on in. Whatever it is, the money that we're going to spend, the military will always get 40% of that. Health and Human Services will always get 1.7% of it. And if we want to adjust it, we have to find a way to adjust that number. We shouldn't be able to just bring in a new department, right? The new department of, Betsy DeVos's home economics or whatever. We shouldn't be able to bring that in and say, okay, the budget's now at 110%. You have to subtract something from somebody's percentage in order to fund that. It's kind of like PAYGO.
Hey, this Thanksgiving, I'm going to be paying thanks to Betsy DeVos's home economics class because that is something I can truly be thankful for, Dan.
So that's an easy question because we are coming up.
I think that plays into the bigger problem with the tax and the budget's plans is what we have is we have a big pot of money that we take money from other people. We put it into
there's
that
no
big,
money in the pot.
There's not any money in the pot, but because as soon as you drop a quarter in the well, somebody's down there fishing it out with a bucket.
Right.
But the problem is that we have a big pot of money that all these programs are supposed to be drawing from. And when that pot of money is empty, we borrow from other programs to put into the big pot of money that other programs are pulling from.
Right. If we just had an idea that we were only going to spend a certain amount of money, I think we'd be a lot better. So, Ken, you mentioned that you were thankful. We got Thanksgiving coming up. You got any good Thanksgiving plans?
I'm going to go hang out with some family, down to New Jersey, think about things I'm thankful for.
That sounds good. How about you?
You know, I'll be with my family and trying to not talk about politics like we are right now. It's going to be a nightmare.
That's an interesting thing. That's a lot of people talk about that is what are the Thanksgiving conversations like Saturday Night Live today? An incredible sketch.
Well, maybe Thanksgiving is time for you to practice, your respectful political conversations where you listen to what people think and give your response in a respectful manner and you have a dialogue back and forth and maybe you actually get some common ground.
I think that is – that is probably the best message that we've ever had. So if we can encourage you, go home or go wherever you're going for Thanksgiving and try to listen and have an honest conversation. Try to promote a real dialogue.
And de-escalate.
De-escalate. All the things that we talk about. Bring it on home. Bring this message home because that's what Thanksgiving's about, right? I mean, if there's something that we're going to be thankful for, it should be the fact that we can have – in this country, at our kitchen tables, at our Thanksgiving tables, a rational conversation.
Free speech and criticism of the government with Crazy Uncle Dave.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, that's what the conversation's all about. So I want to wish you a bountiful Thanksgiving, some wonderful conversation.
And we're all immigrants.
And we are all immigrants.
People talk about sin taxes. The government taxes cigarettes because it says smoking is bad, and they want less people to smoke. The government taxes alcohol because it says drinking is bad, and they want less people to drink. So why is the government taxing income? Join that discussion and lots more, and listen live to Liberty on the Air with your host, Dan Fishman, every Saturday night at 11 p.m. right here on The Voice of Boston, AM 680, WRKO.